Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 17th, 2005. This session is Uncomfortable Neighbors, Vecinos Incómodos, facilitated by Jim Tiffany and Rosemary Lopez Tiffany, in the Crickside Room. This is disc number FO-2005-14A.
We're so grateful to have you here as our guests and for donating this training for us. This is something that costs other organizations $1,500, and they've agreed to do it for room and board, which is pretty nice. So we greatly appreciate you being here, and please introduce yourselves. Thank
you. Go ahead.
She always does that. I am not a Latino person. I was born in Iowa. My people are Irish and English. And a German, I think, is in there to help me get organized and stuff. But I do not represent Latino people or speak for anybody. Nobody elected me, so this is just my opinion. My qualifications are that, number one, that Rosemary said yes about 10 years ago. And that's my main claim to fame. And so we have a little cultural awareness deal going on just about every day in our family. And some of it more pleasant than others, you know. But the big event for me in my life was a move to Mexico that my parents made when I was 10 years old. And that did it for me. It was a 4-year stay. Dad decided that I would go to the local Mexican school, and I was the only person in that school that spoke English. Nobody else did. There wasn't anything like bilingual education or teacher aides or special programs or anything. I was just a problem for the teacher and in fourth grade, and by the time I figured out what was going on, I had flunked fourth grade. So I did 2 years of fourth grade in Mexico. We came back when I was from Mexico, when I was 14 years old, lived in Texas, wound up working with lots of migrant farm workers, migrant farm worker programs, and so on. Pretty much all my life I've been connected one way or another with farm workers and farm worker programs, health, education programs, social services. I spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in the Dominican Republic, in a teacher training program, and I'm, as I said, not a Latino person and don't pretend to be, and so when we do these presentations and Latinos are in the audience, I make sure that they understand I'm not attempting to speak for them, and it's okay to disagree with whatever we say here. I think, did I miss anything? El Mundo, I'm here in I moved to Wenatchee when the mountain blew, May 18th, 1980. That's the day I got here. And so I've lived in Wenatchee ever since. I started El Mundo with the Wenatchee World, the Spanish language paper. And it is now the largest Spanish language weekly in Washington State. And we print about 20,000 papers a week and distribute throughout most of the Latino areas of the state of Washington. So that's what I do. I work in Spanish most of the day and conduct business in English, but work in Spanish for our readers. The book that I wrote, which led to us coming here, and also to the presentations we make, started out as a series of editorials. I just started writing about, because a lot of our readers kept coming in with situations of conflict between them and the Americanos. And so I started writing about these situations of conflict and why the American wants you to look him in the eye and why he thinks you're lying to him if you don't, and stuff like that. And so that, I thought I would write one or two, and it wound up I wrote all year long, a whole series of them. And people kept coming in with more ideas. And after about a year, I had a year's worth of stuff and a book's worth of stuff. and people encouraged us to translate them into English so that the Americans could understand what we're all about. And so that's how the book has worked out, and as you'll see when we start, we're going to go through a very condensed version of the training that we give to people to become informed about Latino culture. That's what it's all about. It's not an in-depth thing. It can't be. It's just a basic introduction. But the book is was in 2003, I think we printed it finally, and we don't have any budget for marketing or anything like that. We're all too busy. Rosemary and I are both full-time employees, and so we don't have time to do that stuff. But it's done amazingly pretty well, and so we're happy about that.
And it's in the bookstore if you don't have your own personal copy.
We get asked a lot to. We over the years, we've been doing these for 10 years now, ever since we met, and it started out very informally. Come to our school and talk to us about how to deal with Latino students, and it has grown in the telling over the 10 years to become probably about a 5 to 6 hour presentation, and so that's where we're at today. And it's still changing and growing. We still, as a result of comments from people, we do change the presentation and come up with new handouts and so on. Okay, are you warmed up now?
Yeah.
Okay. Enough blah blah from me.
Who are you
and why are you here?
Okay. Well, this is a totally new experience for us. We've never been up this direction, and so it was all totally new. I brought, heels and skirts and all that, and I'm like, I'm thinking, I don't think so. So anyway, here we are. But as Jim mentioned, this agenda is more of it's pretty much a full day, an all-day agenda. It's at least 5 to 6 hours long, and we're going to barely touch on it. We're going to probably give you descriptions of labels and talk about assimilation and cover only, probably we have how many characteristics? There must be at least
a bunch. Yeah,
we'll 14, and I think we're only going to cover 3, but someday, if you ever come up to Wenatchee and want to hear a full presentation, we'd be happy to.
So who are you and where were you born?
I am.
All
getting
that
there.
Kind of stuff.
Okay. I'm Rosemary, and I was born in Texas, and grew up born into a very large family of 12, and I'm like the 7th child, middle child in there. We're farm workers, and we followed the agriculture work everywhere, picking cotton and strawberries and cucumbers and what have you. We grew up as a poor family. When there wasn't work or to pick, then we most of the time went on welfare, and we did the food stamps and the medical coupons and the government housing. We lived in the projects, and we also did the cheese line, and you name it, we did that. I started school with no English as well. When Jim went to Mexico, I think what he failed to tell you was that I think his dad put him in that all Mexican school because he was the troublemaker in the family. So Dad thought he'd be safe if he didn't, have to use the English and had to focus on Spanish or some. I don't know.
My brothers and sisters went to the American school down the street.
But he didn't.
I went to the Mexican school.
Yeah. So,
what's that about?
But the end result was great because he learned Spanish quite well, and he functions in Spanish all day long, writing the newspaper and he's written a book in Spanish, so his Spanish is actually better than mine, so that was good. But I went to school without English and absolutely hated school. I discovered all different, or invented all different kinds of illnesses just to stay home because I didn't like school. School was hard for me, and learning English was very difficult for me. I pretty much hated school all the way through high school. Somehow I made it through and entered college, and in college, I think I was treated quite a bit differently. I was treated mostly like a foreign exchange student, and by then, part of what was happening with me is that learning a second language takes 5 to 10 or more years in some cases to really be learn the academic language, and I think that's what was happening to me. So not understanding school was pretty common. But got to the point where during my high school years where I really didn't like my language and really went through a period of denying, rejecting my culture and rejecting my language as well. And as I said, it wasn't until I got to college that I discovered in taking some of the classes that, you know, really my culture is really rich. And it's beautiful. It's got great music. The language is awesome. You know, it just, all these things I learned, but it wasn't until I got to college. And I appreciated who I was and have gone back to really learn the Spanish and speak it now quite a bit. I went on to college and got my degree. Also got my degree in early childhood education, and have taught in bilingual and migrant programs in first grade, second grade, third grade, and pull out ESL classes. I'm currently teaching in a dual language program, kindergarten in a dual language program. I also went on to get my master's in bilingual education as well. Although I've been born and raised here, a lot of my experience is with the people that we're going to describe today, the people that come from Mexico, and also and their families, the experiences that we've discovered through working with those families. And as Jim mentioned, the culture exchanges that he and I go through almost every day. So that's what we're going hope to bring to you today. Thank you.
I'll try to keep myself under control.
Do you use the terminology dual language program rather than bilingual program?
Dual language. Bilingual program has a... It's not seen as very positive. And we've discovered that over the years. Anytime you bring up bilingual, it's a very political word, actually. So we use dual language. We call it dual enrichment program. And for the first time in our district, our school's the only one that's doing that in Wenatchee School District. And this was our very first year, and I had little English kindergarten speakers, 5-year-olds, in my classroom. And my job is to teach the science and social studies in Spanish to them. And when they came in and sat down and I just blurted out all this Spanish, they're like squirming and going, I don't understand you. I don't like this class. And, you know, all kinds of negative stuff because they just weren't understanding me. But by the end of the year, you know, a lot of them understand exactly what you're saying, all the commands and most of what you're saying and a lot of the terminology in science and social studies, they were able to pick it up. It's been awesome. It's been a good experience for us too. Okay.
I'm
gonna start.
You have a packet in front of you. This is just a few of the handouts that Rosemary and I come up with during the course of our presentations. We have lots more, but we have to figure out what not to give people, you know. The agenda on the left there is something that I don't think we've ever finished one, you know, because what we really do, we really want to encourage you to make comments and ask questions, and please feel comfortable in doing that. It's okay no matter what you say. We've pretty much heard it all, and it's okay to be angry about it, or to not like something about this culture or about these people, if that's okay too, but it's all in how you express it. So we want to be sure that, as usually happens in conferences, you know, the best conversation happens out in the hallway during breaks. So we'd really like for that to happen in here. If you have a situation or something that happened to you once, or a question about stuff, please interrupt, bring it up. Okay? That's why we never finish the agenda, because that stuff's important too. Shall we go through the
Right, we're going to start with labels.
Shall we just go through, just briefly? Okay.
Sure.
The second sheet on that left-hand side is the actual, is a piece of scratch paper, really. It's a note paper, and it has the characteristics, and those of you who've read the book are going to recognize these terms, because this is where they came from. It's our attempt to describe Latino culture, and we take a person from rural Mexico, and we say, what is this person like? We try to answer that question. And that process takes us about 3 hours to go through this and talk about each one of these things, give examples, and people have lots of questions typically about these things. Today we're gonna take two of these out of this list and talk about them, two that we feel are the critical ones. If you see something you want to ask a question about, please feel free to. Okay, the next page is suggestions. We hope to be able to get to that after we discuss what these folks are like. Then we talk about, okay, so what do we do about it? And so then we have suggestions on dealing in particular with Latino people. The last sheet is just a kind of a summary, a generalized summary of that, and we can go through this and explain why we feel that way, but that's a result of these suggestions. On the right side, the yellow sheet of paper is something that we typically spend quite a bit of time with. Today, I don't know if we'll be able to, but it's really interesting for those who are dealing with Chicanos as opposed to Mexicanos. We'll talk about the difference in a minute. But this talks about the process of assimilation from when you come into the country to when you start becoming bilingual and then you enter the mainstream. And there are definite stages and definite behavioral issues involved there. So we'll try to pay some attention to this yellow sheet when we get to it. Okay. The rest are just kind of items of interest that we thought you might be interested in. And so as we go along, if you're reading through this, please feel free to go ahead and ask or make a comment. Doesn't matter if we're on or off the agenda. Okay, Rosa Maria.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like to do now?
I personally like these two because it really sums up most of what I think we're trying to say. So
okay.
They're in the packet. Okay.
Okay. We want to talk about terms.
Start with terms.
So what do we call these people? Yeah. If you have the term Spanish to apply to a person. We're going to ask you to try to get rid of that, to not use that term. We just heard it the other day, didn't we? Just yesterday or something. Somebody was explaining something that a Spanish man did when he came into the store. And I thought, God, the guy was from Spain, huh? But no, he was talking about a Mexican immigrant. So we want to be sure not to use this term for people. Spaniards are rank even under the mighty gringo in the Mexican scheme of things. So for obvious historical reasons, Spanish is just not something we want to call people unless we're sure that we're talking about a Spaniard. Bueno. Then everybody became Mexican, and they still are if you're in Texas. I used to live in Texas, and everybody called everybody Mexicans, you know, including the... If you're one of my Salvadoran friends, you're going to have a real problem with being called Mexican. And so we want to make sure that we don't do that. So we want to avoid that term, too. Unfortunately, it's a slightly pejorative term, depending on where you're coming from. Whole country people, Mexican, you know. And we were in Yakima listening to a speech from Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, who at that time was a candidate for president. And he talked about being good Mexicans. We want to be good Mexicans and work hard to be good Mexicans. And it was just, at first I thought, oh, wait a minute. And then, you know, the more he used it and the more comfortable he was with it, I thought, well, gee, yeah. that's pretty cool. He can say that word without it being a put down or anything. It just is. It's a country of people. Okay? Mexican American. This is the term that most Latinos in the country prefer. If you ask them, they will, about 67% say they prefer this term to be used. And the Salvadoran Americans will prefer that, and the Guatemalan Americans will prefer that. So those are the terms they prefer to be identified by country of origin. So, and we know how critical country of origin really is. Although we Americanos look at them all and just say Hispanics. And within that group, there's just this huge diversity that they themselves really recognize easily by talking and looking at each other that you and I wouldn't see.
I have an analogy. My mother is from Norway, and sometimes we'll ask her if she's from Sweden. Well, no, she's not from Sweden.
Oh, yeah. Oh, exactly, yeah.
Right.
Chicano is a term that's used pretty much around the colleges. Most of people who go and take Chicano studies or learn about the Mexican culture all of a sudden become Chicanos. But it comes from...
Chicano, Mexicano. Original Indian term for Mexico. And so this is an exclusive term. Our Salvadoran friends, again, cannot be Chicanos. And so what we hear a lot more increasingly is Chicano / Latino, almost said as one word, Chicano Latino. So you're seeing Chicano Latino studies now instead of Chicano studies to be more inclusive. This is seen as a derogatory or slightly pejorative by older folks for the most part. Mom, dad, maybe grandpa and grandma, they probably won't like this term. And because in the old days it was that way. And so they don't, it's the younger crowd that's going to prefer this term.
There's a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had always understood Chicano as a term that came in the 1960s or so by folks of Mexican origin who were born in the U.S., so folks of Mexican born in Mexico, Chicano, a Mexican family were born in the U.S.
That's how it's used today. That's how the Mexico City press that I follow refers to Chicanos, a Chicano movement, or Chicano housing project, or a Chicano project. Whenever you see that term, it means American-born people of Mexican descent. And that could be parents or great-grandparents, or who knows how far back. Rosemary's family is from Texas. They never moved anywhere. The border crossed them. But, they, as far as we could determine in interviewing her parents and their great uncles and people like that, they claim they just popped out of the ground there. They were always there, you know. So,
most of my, my parents and my grandparents were all, I know, were all from Texas. And I think in my family, I'm the only one that's ever been to Mexico. No one else is. I mean, they're not familiar with Mexico at all.
So, she gets asked, what part of Mexico are you from?
I know. I always say Texas, because that's where I'm from. But, you know, it's funny because we assume, and that's why we're talking about terms, that everybody comes from Mexico sometimes. And that's why that term, I mean, that question, what part of Mexico are you from? You know, I'm always asked that, but you know, when you really think about it, a lot, especially in my family, who's a family of 12, never even been to Mexico, and my mom, I don't think, ever went to Mexico. So it's interesting how we just kind of assume that everyone has been there, but isn't. Okay, the next term is Hispanic.
It gets confusing, even when among them, because when I go to a fiesta or something at Rosemary's family, they all call each other Mexicans. And they're not Mexicans. None of them are. Yeah. Oh, you Mexican. Yeah. Usually they say stupid Mexican.
I don't.
That's too bad. No, Rosemary doesn't, but her brother sure do. Yeah. And they joke around about it.
Well, part of it is, I think, As we were growing up, it was such a derogatory word. It really was. I mean, if you used the word Mexican, it wasn't ever in a nice way. And you heard it on TV, on television. It was used very derogatory, and in movies and such. So I think my family uses that label and applies it in a negative way sometimes, unfortunately.
Hispanic is a term that came into vogue with the 1980 census. The government had to have a term to identify this group somehow. And so they picked this term, Hispanic. It's still in use a lot here on the West Coast, Western states, we still hear it. Pretty much equal with Latino right now. But it's fading out, it's getting objected to a lot because it means of or pertain to Spain. So there you go, Spain again. So a lot of folks do not want to be of or pertaining to Spain. So they don't want to be called Hispanics. So, but it's still, unless you're at the university or something, it's still a pretty neutral term. And you will hear Rosemary and I interchanging Hispanic and Latino quite frequently. We do it in the paper. El Mundo has probably about equal use, although it's going to, the trend is toward Latino.
Latino.
That's the term. On the East Coast, everybody's already Latino. You know, it's all, that's, but here on the West Coast, we still have that Hispanic hanging on. But if you are ever in doubt about what term to use, choose Latino first, and you probably won't go wrong. Latino for the male person, Latina for the female person, Latinos for everybody. Okay?
Well, sometimes people ask us, who are the Latinos? So here's just a basic list.
That's a new one. She put Puerto Ricans on the top after our last presentation.
Yeah, a lot of complaints.
Because there was a Puerto Rican in the audience. And she got after us for not having Puerto Ricans on that list. So,
and we threw Texans in there and Chicanos. And,
yeah. It's very diverse. It's about the most diverse group that you can imagine. Most Puerto Ricans and Caribbean island types where I spent in the Peace Corps, Dominican Republic, most of the population is African American, and they speak all this beautiful Spanish. You know, I come home from Dominican Republic expecting every black person I saw to speak Spanish. You know, it was quite a shock for me. There are countries like Ecuador and Guatemala that are heavily American Indian. There are 13 million Mexicans who don't speak Spanish and don't call themselves Latinos. In Argentina, there's 90%, 98% of the people are white Europeans, half the country are Italian citizens. You know, so this is a huge variety of people, the entire spectrum, and we clump them all together and call them Latinos. Latino is not, from Latin, it means Latino Americano, Latin American. So we're not talking about Italians or French, we're talking about anyone with a Latin American background. That breaks apart too, because what about Brazilians, you know, Haitians, Jamaicans? I mean, you know, they don't think of themselves as Latinos. So any way you look at it, it's difficult to group people and put a big label on them. And so, and approach with caution and just ask. We just need to relax about it and ask. And not stress out, and it'll be okay. You can ask anybody anything if you do it respectfully. My mother didn't like the term. She's pure Irish. O'Donohoe was the maiden name. And she did not like the term Anglo. Because we're, in this room, we're all Anglos, except maybe one here. But, you know, I'm looking out at all you folks, I'm just, it's a bunch of Anglos. You know, well, wait a minute. If my mother was out there, she'd say, don't you call me an Anglo. She was tall, red head, ruddy cheeks. She's pure Irish. She said, I'm Irish. We don't have anything to do with the English. You know. So be careful with these labels. They can get you.
For today's purposes, we're going to be really focusing on the person from rural Michoacan, because in some of the surveys that, you know, we've done, and in our schools, for example, we've realized that a lot of our people come from an area called Michoacan in Mexico, the state of Michoacan. And in fact, most of the people that are found here in the state are from that area. Some come from Oaxaca, some come from other little places, but for the most part, we have people who are here from this area, from the state of Michoacan.
Where is this area?
In coming right up.
Oh, you just fell right into that one. Uh-huh. Look, there happens
All
to
right.
be a map just for you.
There happens to be a map. This is a map of Mexico here, and apparently this is Mexico City. Michoacan, if I'm correct, is
just about there.
Just about right here. And then Oaxaca is down in this area. So,
and Jalisco, those three. Right
yeah,
there.
Zacatecas is right in here. But the area, the people that we're going to be describing today come from this area.
It's about 1,100 miles south of San Diego, which is about 1,100 miles south of here. This is not just a jump over the fence. This is an odyssey. This is a huge trip to get here, over unfriendly territory. So all of those folks who are here have come through fire and water to get here, and they all have a story. A lot of those stories we just really enjoy telling in El Mundo, because they're really interesting how people wind up in the state of Washington, you know, from wherever they are in Mexico.
We people ask us why Washington? I mean, why are people from Michoacan up in Washington? And we're like, we don't know. We asked some people from Zacatecas, some teachers that we know there. It's like, why aren't there people from Zacatecas in Washington? And apparently, he said that most of them travel up to Chicago. That's the direction they go. Is that correct? And then, you know, depending on where you're from, that's the direction you go. And to me, I related a lot to the Santa Fe Trail, the Oregon Trail, you know, all those trails that existed here where people would follow their family or whatever was easiest at the time. But I don't think we've asked. We have had, Jim's book has really sold in one state that if we did have a book agent, I don't think we would have promoted it up in that direction right away. Until we were pretty well off the ground. But
you'd think it'd be Texas, or?
You think it'd be Texas, or you think it'd be
Arizona,
some state down in this area, but it's North Carolina. We have had to send more books up to North Carolina. I think everyone in the state has a book. I mean, practically, I mean, the way they've been buying books, it seems like everyone, at least everyone in the schools, probably has a copy of it. So apparently they've had an influx of people from Mexico, and I don't know what part of Mexico. I guess I haven't asked that question before. So it's real interesting. North Dakota, we were told, had a big influx of people and so on. Okay. Moving on.
We're going to talk about trying to describe a Mexicano person, and we're going to use stereotypes, and then we're going to tell you don't do that, you know? So don't do what we do. We're going to talk about stereotypes, but we're going to try to keep in mind that stereotypes are dangerous and lead to lots of misunderstandings, but it's also a way to try to get a handle on a group of people who share a lot of beliefs and characteristics and behaviors. And so we're going to use stereotypes, and but with care, you know. I'm not sure. How many of you folks here are from Washington State? So we have not even the majority. Not from Washington State is... Oh. Well, a whole bunch of you just decided not to raise your hand. Fine, thanks.
Me originally or now living here?
Ah, okay. I should have. Yeah, good question. Okay, let's say how many of you are living in Washington State now? Okay, so and how many of you are not?
Yeah.
So,
that's pretty good.
Well, it's about half and half, huh?
Yeah.
So, in our state of Washington, we have. I ask that because when we talk about describing what does a Mexican person look like, those of us from Washington State think we know the answer to that. And I don't know the folks, those of you who are not from here, if you would share that description. But every once in a while we see in the newspapers around here, the suspect was a 30-year-old Latino male. Yeah, kind of, you chuckle about that, because if you were in, you know, Guadalajara, that wouldn't mean a thing, would it? I mean, or in Los Angeles, it wouldn't mean a thing either. So let's describe this guy. What's this 30-year-old Latino male look like? How tall is he?
5'6".
Okay, he's short. He's short. He's not going to be tall, is he? Is he? Does he tend to be stocky, or does he tend to be thin?
Stocky.
Stocky, that's correct. See, you guys know this. Does eye color?
Brown,
of course. Dark. Absolutely. Hair?
Black
hair. Curly or straight?
Either.
Yeah.
Okay, there we got some difference. Mostly straight. Complexion? Dark? Dark skin. Okay. People, what else? Anything else? Mustache? Maybe. Okay. What's that?
Not bearded, though.
Not bearded.
Not bearded,
some,
no.
Some sort of vision.
Not bearded, but most likely a mustache. There you go. 30-year-old Latino man. We got him. He's short, stocky, dark eyes, straight dark hair, medium brown complexion, and a mustache. Now, why do we think we know that? We know plenty of people. Our friend Chewy down there in Wenatchee, he looks like one of my Irish uncles for all the world. Ruddy skin, loud voice and everything, doesn't even speak English. You know, blue eyes. There's a lot of folks like that. But we think that they all look this way. One of the reasons is that, well, as a matter of fact, a lot of them do. And the map that Rosemary put up and that trail is the reason why. A lot of those folks from Michoacán, Oaxaca, and that central area of Mexico, south central, tend to come this way. And they do share that. There's a lot of American Indian in that group. And so they share that look. Okay. All right. So we need to say to you, beware of generalizing from personal experience, because if you were... You go to Mexico City and all of a sudden there's all kinds of folks that don't look like that. You know? All right. So we're going to try to talk about acculturation, and we're going to describe what happens when these people come to the United States and some of the attitudes that they have. We're going to try to go through this list, and we're going to talk about, for example, we say, well, what, because we get that question, what are these people like? What are Mexicanos like? Well, okay, they tend to be more spiritualistic, for example, than materialistic. So what does that mean? Well, that means that when you come in a room and you say hello to everybody, but you forget to say hello to Jose, you're in trouble because his spiritualistic radar is on you. And not only that, but if you say hello in a friendly way to everybody, but a not-so-friendly way to him, he registers that too. It's a very different kind of radar system. It's tuned into a spiritual side. I've learned that in hiring, when I hire people. I've learned to involve Rosemary. My radar is, well, do you qualify, and what level of education did you have, and what kind of a salary do you want, you know, and I'm checking you out to see how you're dressed and stuff like that. And Rosemary's tuning into other things. I'm not sure how it happens, but
she will be able to tell me that person's going to fit in with the staff, or I don't see that person fitting in real well. There's a different radar there. It's on the spiritualistic side. Anyway, I wasn't supposed to do that, was I?
Right. I didn't want to be rude. No, what we had decided was that during our five-hour presentation, we go through each one of those, and because today we have, 2 hours or less, we're going to focus on just probably family-centered and self-centered, and then respectful.
So you can tell our priority list. Because when we sat down and said, okay, what really important ones are we going to pick? Those are the two that we pick. You want to start out with family center?
I think so.
Okay. So ask a Americano. If we ask an Americano, hey, you know, who is James Brown? What are they going to say? Well, you know Jane, she's the bartender down at Pastime. And then at night she works over at A&W. That's who she is. Right? Who's John Smith? Oh, he's the principal over at high school. Yeah. When we ask who somebody is, they'll tell us what we do. Right? What does a Mexicano tell you when you ask them, who is Jose Lopez? Exactly. You're going to get the family tree, aren't you? Oh, you know Jose. He's the neighbor of the guy who's the teacher at the school where little Janie goes. Yeah, and he's Johnny's uncle. Really, and he's related to Freddie by his third marriage or whatever it is. You're going to get this whole family description. Because that's who you are. The Latino person, you are your family. One of the things that we have a lot of trouble with, we Americanos, is the understanding that we are not dealing with individuals. When we deal with a Latino person, that is not an individual person. And that's tough for us because we come from one of those countries that the sociologists call the individualistic countries. And the other group they call collectivistic, you know, and they do these surveys or these studies of countries. It's really kind of interesting, and I'll just share one of those with you. Five countries were I think it was, the total group was something like 45. The top five individualistic countries all speak the same language. It turns out, they're all English speakers. And it's interesting, the top five, or number one individualistic was United States. Number two was Australia, number three was Great Britain, number four was Canada, number five is New Zealand. All English, because that was really interesting to us. Because the five top collectivistic group, three of them were Spanish speakers. That was interesting. Number one was Venezuela, number two was Colombia, and number four was Peru. The others were Pakistan and Taiwan. But that means it's a really fundamentally different way of looking at the world. You know, to motivate an American, we say, you know, get out there and be the best you can be, and do for you, and make lots of money, and you drink this beer, and the side of the truck flops out, and these beautiful women jump out, and it turns into a beach. It's all for you, you know. In Mexico, you see advertising that almost always involves the family. When you drink this beer, the side of the truck flops out, and there's your family and a bunch of kids running around, and then you can sit down and enjoy your family. You know, and so it's a really different way of looking at stuff. What does it mean for the classroom? For example, a teacher, the typical individualistic example to use if you're talking to teachers is the spelling bee. You know, that spelling bee, where when I was a kid, did the spelling bee, we all stood up in front of the room. And as you misspell the word, you go sit down. And so the last one standing is the winner, hooray for you. You know, well, the Mexicano kid would rather be with the 25 losers than standing up there as a winner. Because he's not an individualist, you know. And he grows up in a society that tells him, it's not about you, it's about your family. You know? And even to compliment a Mexicano is difficult, because that's singling them out. We see that all the time in them. When we want to interview someone or take someone's picture, they get nervous and say, nah, you know, not me, please, no, you know, because the first thing that's going to happen are his friends are going to say, oh man, now you think you're better than we are. You know, now you're up there, look, your picture's in the paper, you think you're really cool. You know, and they'll bring him right back down. It's really different. Our Anglo people that we talk, oh yeah, sure, take my picture. That's cool, I was in the paper. You know, because it's about the individual.
Belonging to a group is so much more important than, as Jim says, being an individual or being recognized as an individual. And that goes for, I mean, we've talked to people at the, what do you call them, apple plants, where
packing
sheds, where they have chosen people who seem to exhibit some real strong leadership skills. And so they choose them to come up here and be the supervisor, and they don't last long. So they were asking us, why is that? Why don't they, I mean, you know, we're doing them a favor. We're raising them. We're giving them a higher status, you know, a higher position. But yet they'd rather quit and go back to being down there sorting apples or whatever it is. And we tell them it has to do with belonging to a group. You know, belonging to a group, being part of a collective group is so much more important than being an individual. And that goes for, you know, the working in the apples or in school, as Jim mentioned. Our kids in my classroom, I try to have them compete as a group, and I have them sitting at tables like you do. And I don't know what your positions are at work, but if you have meetings and if you want people to give input, it's best to have them seated in little groups like this. In my classroom, I call it more of a first of all, we start off the year by saying we are a family. You know, we will be together for so many months. We are going to treat each other like a nice family. And then I design the classroom so that they are little family units and that they take care of each other as a little family. And they compete as a group. They work together as a group. And it seems to be much more beneficial than if I had them in individual desks, because they won't participate that way. They won't volunteer, they don't participate, but in small groups they will. So having them be, treating them as a small group really works best, I think.
So. And motivation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know what I was going to say. As far as in Mexico, when we went on a teacher exchange program there, some of the schools that we visited, we saw them recognizing not individuals, but recognizing classrooms. They would reward them or recognize them. For example, every Friday or Monday, I'm not sure which one it is, there would be the class that had the best attendance, and they'd make a big, everyone goes out to the courtyard, and then they have a little parade, and they have all kinds of, the flag salute thing that happens. And then they would recognize the classroom that had the best attendance or the classroom that had the cleanest classroom, for example, or, I don't know, came up with different things, best grades that week. But they were recognized as a whole group.
The I was going to show this. You've all seen this, I think, in various... It's a big, slick... $1 zillion advertising campaign. It's old, it's been years ago. You know, this is your brain, and this is drugs, and this is your brain on drugs. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's our Mexicano friend going to think of this ad? Gonna say, throw some chorizo on there, let's eat. Right? I mean, this isn't gonna do a thing for him. How are we gonna talk to him about drugs? What kind of a visual are we gonna give him?
Family structure breaking down.
Family structure breaking down, okay. Show a picture of your mother crying. Look what you did. You shamed your mother. You took drugs back. Now that's going to get it. That's going to reach you because that's where he lives. It's about your family. It's not about you. And we see that. We see that with Rosemary in her class a lot. She seldom says, good for you. You did so good. You were great and stuff like that. She says, your mom and dad are going to be really proud.
Mm-hmm.
That's what does it.
I try to bring in the family as much as possible. Always. Always bring in the family. You know, your mom and dad are going to be so proud of you. You did so great, and they're going to be so happy for you. Because I really do believe it's all about the family. And always remembering to include them. And we talk about, sometimes I have trouble getting my kids to learn their sounds or letters or whatever it is that they have to learn. And one way I can improve on that is to pull in an older brother and sister that may attend the same school or may not. But typically, they're probably not that much older than the student I'm working with. They may just be a third grader or a fourth grader that I pulled in. Because I know that if I pull in that little brother and sister, the one that they worship, you know, the brother and sister that they just adore, they're going to come in and they're going to help me as much as possible to help them. And I generally have good results. If I pull in those older brothers and sisters, and when I can't find anyone at my school, I go digging in the homes. You know, there's got to be an uncle, there's got to be someone there that they really admire, and so I try to pull them in to help me. In a lot of cases, my families have not had the opportunities to go to school themselves. And so I find you always try to find a key person in that family that can help you to help to get your point across or to teach kids. So.
Latino people generally put a high value on humility. There's a real aversion to bragging. And this has real consequences. Often we see a well-qualified Latino candidate for a position not get hired. It's just been so frustrating for us. And we've known several of these instances personally that has happened. And what comes down is that the Latino person doesn't do well on the interview, where you're supposed to get out there and brag like crazy and tell how great you are and all these things you can do. To the Mexicano, you're going to ask, you're interviewing, you know, do you know anything about working on, you know, Fords? And this guy's a world-class mechanic sitting there looking at you, and he's going to say, well, yeah, I think I can. You're going to think to yourself, well, this guy's not very secure. But you know what he's doing? He's showing humility. That's what his culture tells him to do. He can't, it's very, very difficult in the Latino world to stand up on your soapbox and brag. We have next to us here the North Central Washington Teacher of the Year this year. Migrant Education Teacher of the Year, 1997. All kinds of stuff. Her students routinely, you know, score way up there in comparison to others and etc. But you don't know that. You never know that. I'm not going to tell you that stuff. It's because it's not about you. It's about your family.
And Jim's right. You know, I sometimes sit in interviews, and you might too. And if you interview Latinos, you know, we need to learn to ask more open-ended questions. if you ask the yes and no question, even if they're, as Jim mentioned, highly qualified, they're probably just going to say, yeah, I think I could do that, or I might know a little bit about that, when they really do know a lot about it, but they're not going to tell you. So learning to ask those open-ended questions in interviews is really critical. Or if you're a nurse or a doctor, learning to ask the questions that will get you the results, or asking them in different ways, because generally there's an aversion to bragging. They're not going to brag about who they are or what they have or how good they are. They're not going to do that for you. We've passed up a lot of good candidates in some of the interviews we've done, and I know that they are really good, but I can't convince my group that they're good, because what came out in the interview didn't appear that great. And so that's pretty tough when we hear that, when we see that, when we pass up someone because they didn't toot their own horn like we're told to do.
Yes.
To what degree is this continuing to be true in generations that are born here? Say the parents of my students were born in Mexico, but my students themselves born here. To what degree is this sort of powerful piece of culture that's different?
It wears down. It wears down. You mean the aversion to bragging?
It's a kind of more individualistic.
Right. The Chicano is much more individualistic than the Mexicano is. What we do in this presentation is we remind everyone every once in a while that, remember, we're talking about rural Mexico here. And so we describe the rural Mexican person and culture, and then we translate that to here and say, okay, now, and that yellow piece of paper talks about that. What happens when those folks get here, and then American culture influences, and then how that changes. And this does change. The connection to family stays very strong all the way through. But the thing about bragging and the individualism, that does weaken, and Chicanos are much more like Americans than they are like Mexicans in that respect.
Yeah, and that's one thing we failed to cover, you know, to say, is that we are talking about just the rural Michoacan person, the recent arrival group, because there is such a big difference between the ones that were born here and the Tejanos and the Chicanos. I mean, everyone is different in how, in these characteristics, they wouldn't all behave the same. Apply to the more recent arrival group. But you know, the Tejanos, the Chicanos, they'll stare you down, they'll challenge you, they'll stand up, you know, they'll stand up and face you, and face you off. And it's like where a Mexicano, a more recent arrival person, will probably shy away from a situation and won't challenge you hardly at all. And they don't challenge us as at school at all. So there is a difference. And people have asked us, why don't you do a, because we do the Mexicano presentation, and they've asked us to do one on the more adapted group, the group that's been here forever, because it is different.
Which we try to get to, but
yeah.
We have Chicano friends who get very irritated with us when we say that you're a lot more like white Americans than you are like rural Mexicans. They get unhappy with that, because I think emotionally they identify with that Mexican roots, you know. But really in their behavior, they're just so much more like Americans. You had a question.
I wanted an example of reframing the question so that it was more open-ended. What you were talking about a couple minutes ago.
Tell me about your family. Mm-hmm. That's the best question you can ask a Latino person. Now you're going to get all the information you want.
But what if you want to know whether you can fix the forts?
Right.
Yeah, tell me about your family. Do
well,
you have
you
any,
say, can you
any
fix,
mechanics
can you fix
in your family? What kind of cars do you have in your family? What, you know, tell me what you, can your brother do that too? How about you? Do you help him? I mean, you know, that is the single best open-ended question to ask, because you get all kinds of stuff back.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you asked, do you know how to fix Fords, they'd probably go, yeah, I could probably fix Ford. You know, when they, that's what they probably do all the time. But maybe, you know, what type of Fords are you familiar with? Which ones have you worked on?
Why did you become a mechanic?
Right.
Do you like working on cars?
One where they actually have to respond in more than one sentence or in complete sentences rather than just a yes-no response. And I guess that's, you know, something different than a yes-no would be an open-ended question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Could you comment a little bit on the humility bragging thing when someone is talking about another person? Because I can think of a number of experiences where when I'm asking or wanting to know something about someone else's ability, where it has seemed to be inflated by the other person.
Of course, they can fix anything,
you know. And I don't know how, if that's just that it's an unusual experience or if this.
No, that's
talking about another person.
Well, you touched on an interesting thing that we, yeah, that Rosemary likes to talk about, the intermediary. Because what we have is a group of people who don't want to talk about themselves. And so what happens when a kid needs a pencil? Is he going to go up and say to the teacher, you know, I lost my pencil? Well, that's a little dangerous, so he doesn't want to. So what happens? His buddy will. Hey, Jose needs a pencil. So what does the American teacher say? Tell Jose
to come
ask me. Right. So the Latino teacher would not do that. Latino teacher said, oh, Jose needs a pencil. Well, okay, here. Well, tell Jose he can go over and, you know, you accept the mediator. Even in work situations, Francisco has a problem with the way we're taking breaks. Well, the American supervisor will say, tell Francisco to come to me, my door is open. You know? But that's because we're direct types, individualistic types. We can look you in the eye. You got a problem, you come to me. You know? That doesn't happen in the Latino world. I mean, it's intermediaries are really very common. They brag for each other because they can't for themselves.
Mm-hmm. They will do that. And even you know, like 5-year-olds in my kindergarten class, there's always so and so needs to go to the restroom. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know. So or they don't have any scissors or whatever it is, and so you just want to blurt out, well, tell them to go get them themselves, you know. But I understand that it is much safer to approach through someone else than to go directly yourself. And so in the classroom situation, I try to create it so that this, as I mentioned earlier, through cooperative grouping, this is a table, this is one little unit, and I assign, I assign the I call it teacher, or you can call it leader or captain. And so you're going to be our teacher for this group, and anything your group needs, you'll come and get. And if you need anything, you need to make sure you let her know. She'll come and ask me. So I create that for them so that they feel safe. We went to one school where some teacher just said, but I want them to learn to be independent and to learn to ask themselves. And I mean, I think that at some point they need to speak up for themselves. Honey, she's trying to get it.
They need to change the tape in about 10 minutes, so that might
be
a good time to
start.
Oh,
sorry. Okay. There's
a comment
over here.
Sorry, I just had a question about how in the dual classroom, how the American culture interacts with the Latino culture. Because I'm curious how the American kids, or whatever, the Caucasian, whatever group have you, how they react and whether the cultures meld or whether they remain separate or one's predominant or how they interact in a purely dual situation.
Well, one of the reasons that we decided to go with dual language was because what we were seeing on the playgrounds was a separation of cultures. Mm-hmm. We really truly were seeing there wasn't a mixture and of kids at all. We went to the lunchroom, you saw the same thing. We went everywhere we saw was that the separation. So that was one of the reasons, I think, that we decided to go with dual language. in the beginning, it's tough because you get kids who have never, ever played with anyone else of a different color. You know, in both. You have the Latino and you have the Caucasian kid who's never played with each other. And in the beginning, it's tough because they don't even accept me. And I have to speak to them totally in Spanish. I can't speak to them in English. And they don't like me. They just don't like me because tell me in English. Now, they can speak to me in English, but I'll respond in Spanish. And so in the beginning, they don't even like me either. And they don't really like each other. But one of the part of the program, one of the components of the program is that you create dual language buddies. You assigned a buddy. And so you have a Spanish-speaking buddy and an English-speaking buddy, and you are going to work together. And pretty soon, you learn to rely on your buddy, because for you to get that activity done or the project done or whatever it is done, you have to rely on your buddy. You have to ask them. So you're constantly working together. You're always working together. What we have found is that they become friends. They go out to the playground, and now you see kids really mixing. We don't have to mix them for you anymore. They are just, you know, doing it on their own. One of the cool things that we saw this year was that when kids were having parties, like the Caucasian kids, the parents were actually inviting the Latino kids over to the parties. And that was something that really doesn't happen. Really doesn't happen.
And they don't respond very well, really.
But we have...
Latino kids don't like to go, especially to stay over.
Oh, the staying over, parents have asked us, you know, why don't they stay over? We've asked them to stay over, and that's not very common. The staying over doesn't happen. I never stayed over anybody's house throughout my whole life, you know, or as a growing up in the family. But our Anglo-speaking parents, our Anglo parents have... One of the things that we do is we have meetings as well, not just for the kids, but for the parents, because it's not just the kids who are learning the language and the culture. We've asked the parents to also try to learn the language and the culture and to stay on top of it, because pretty soon this kid is going to keep rising and you're going to end up down here. You're not going to understand your child. You're not going to understand each other. And so the parents have been pretty involved. So the invitation of the to the different parties, we've had parents who've come to us and asked us, you know, what is the best way for me to do this? Should I just send the invitation? Should I send the invitation in English or Spanish? Should I pick them up? Should I call the parent? You know, what do I do? And what we have found is that they've been at each other's parties, and it's been really fun for them. Lots of fun. And the blending is happening naturally.
In society, you know, it's our little bubble there. It's come full circle. Years ago, there was... bilingual education was a hot topic of controversy. Mm-hmm. And now, today, there's this huge waiting list of people wanting to get into this dual language program. So it's pretty cool.
This was our first year in dual language, and then we had kindergarten registration recently, and we must have 50 kids that have signed up for kindergarten. And probably out of those 50, we have 45 who want dual language for their kids. And that says a lot.
In a dual language, does that mean that we have some classes in English and some in Spanish?
Yes, with no translation.
Mm-hmm. Our kids, and here's basically this is what it looks like. In the morning, they come as a mixed group. So we would have Spanish and English speakers, and they're there for about 30 minutes. Then we do separate for literacy. The English speakers go to the other classroom, the Spanish speakers stay with me to learn Spanish literacy, because we believe in teaching them in their native language. Mm-hmm. And then about 10:30, they come back together to do what we call bilingual centers, where they are with their buddy, they're always with their buddy, and they go off to a center and they complete a project together, they work together to either do a project in Spanish or do a project in English. Could mean going to a listening center where you're listening to a story in Spanish, or maybe it's English. And then in the afternoon, the homeroom, the mixed group goes to math. One mixed group goes to math, and they do math totally in English because that is going to be their academic content language. And then in the and then later on, one group comes to me for science or social studies, and that is totally in Spanish. That is their content language in Spanish. And then we flip-flop. But I do two sessions of science. She does two sessions of math. And it's amazing. It's amazing what they can learn. And most of my kids had very good receptive language, where they had heard Spanish all year long. And if I just spoke to them in Spanish, you know, if we were doing a science project and we were doing floating and sinking, and I would say, ¿está flotando? ¿O se hundió? ¿Está flotando? And they go, ¡flotando! You know, it's floating. So they have that language, they're receptive. They don't have a lot of expressive, although by the end of the year, it seemed to be coming out more and more. But it's really interesting. It's really hard to get the program off the ground. It's not... Anyone who tells you it's easy to get that program off is lying to you. It's really hard because I was the type of person who likes to go in my classroom and just work hard. I work really hard. I shut my door, work hard, I teach my kids, But in a dual language program, you really have to, it's like a marriage. You really have to work hard with the other partner because you're always mixing kids. You don't have 25 kids any longer. You have, in our case, we had basically 30 kids in each classroom, so you have 60 kids during the day. And you have to be really able to work with the other person to get that program off the ground. And that was one of the things we kind of didn't understand very well in the beginning. But I think that it's going to be a successful program. These kids are now going on to first grade where they will do a little bit more of the same that they did this year. And then in second grade, they will also receive instruction in the other language, in literacy. So they'll start learning to read Spanish, and the others will start learning to read English. And they will continue that way all the way up fifth or sixth grade. So
we need a break.
We
take
about
7.5 minutes. 7.5 minutes.
Wow.
American minutes.
American.
Then we'll talk about race.